This episode is brought to you by Essentia. A better you starts with better hydration. Essentia is on a mission to inspire people to do what matters most. Their proprietary ionization process transforms water from any source into ionized alkaline water, providing water that's 99.9% pure with a pH of 9.5 or higher. Essentia overachieving H2O, the number one ionized alkaline water. Shop now.
Hello and welcome to Instant Genius, a bite-sized masterclass in podcast form. I'm Alice Lipscomb-Southwell, the managing editor at BBC Science Focus magazine. Now, Christmas is just around the corner, and I don't know about you, but I love Christmas and I'm already super excited about it. But what bird could be more associated with the festive season than the robin? In this episode, I chat to Helen Wilson, a professor of human geography at Durham University. She has written a book, Robin, all about one of the nation's favourite birds, which investigates their natural history and their role in our culture. Now, Helen, you've written a book all about robins. Now, would you say that robins are perhaps our most familiar bird?
I would say, yes, that robins are one of the most familiar birds in the UK. Obviously, you know, depending on who you ask, people will have different answers to this question, but they are very familiar, and I think there's a number of reasons why they are. So the first is their distinctiveness. It's very, very easy to identify a robin. They have that distinctive ruddy coloured breast. If you think about how we learn about animals and birds when we're very, very young, the robin is often one bird that we learn. Well, we learn about the robin earlier, precisely because they're so easy to identify. It's also because they're so common as well. So, you know, you'll see robins in gardens, you'll see them in cities, the countryside. They do have a tendency to come quite close. So we do have that opportunity as well to see them regularly. So not only are they distinctive, they're very easy to come across. And then, of course, you know, there is their presence in culture, in British culture. So they're present in nursery rhymes, but they're also an icon of Christmas. So you can't move at Christmas time without seeing a robin. They'll be on your wrapping paper, your Christmas cards, your stamps. They'll be hanging from trees. So, yes, it's quite difficult to get through your year without seeing at least one robin.
And you said that they're quite associated with British culture, but do we find robins anywhere else in the world?
Yeah, absolutely. So we're talking here about the European robin. So yes, they are distinctive in British culture, but the European robin actually has quite an extensive range. So they can be found across Europe, they can be found in North Africa, parts of the Middle East, but also western parts of Asia as well. So quite an extensive range for the European robin. So the European robin has quite an extensive range, but then there are many other robins across the world that appear in different bird lists. Some of them belong to the same family as the European robins. So you'll have robin chats and bush robins and magpie robins, scrub robins, and they're robins of all colours and sizes. You might think of the American robin, for example. So there's lots of other robins beyond the European robin, and they can be found the world over.
Now, concentrating here on the European robin, because that's the one we're most familiar with. Now, if we get them coming into our garden, is there a way to tell the males from the females, or can you even tell an individual robin apart from another one?
An easy answer there is no, probably not. They are very, very difficult to tell the difference between a female and a male. So some birds will have quite distinctive plumage and it'll be very, very easy to tell the two apart. But with the European robin, no. Actually, there's a slight difference in size, but it's very, very difficult to discern. So even close up, actually, it's quite hard to tell the difference between the two birds. In terms of individual robins, some people will argue that you can tell the difference, or at least you can recognise individual robins. If you have a garden robin that you feed regularly, that you see on a daily basis, people talk about building up this relationship with their garden robin and being able to identify their garden robin. That might be the case. It might also be a mistake to assume that the robin you see every single year is the same robin. But yeah, you might be able to tell the difference in that context.
Now, you touched on it there that people almost build this relationship with the robins in their garden, and indeed robins are called the gardener's friend. Now, why are robins friendlier than other birds? Because it certainly seems that other birds just fly away from us.
Yeah. And again, so yeah, you maybe put, you know, when we talk about the robin being a friendly bird, you know, maybe use that in inverted commas, but it is to do with their feeding behavior. So first of all, they do like to feed on worms and grubs. And so when we hear this kind of account of them being the gardener's friend, that is largely to do with the way that they hang around when we garden. So if you've ever been out in the garden and you've turned over the soil or you've done some digging, you'll notice that robins appear quite quickly. And this is because they've spotted an opportunity for earthworms or other insects that have been revealed as part of this gardening activity. So they'll stay close by as an opportunity to then dip in and kind of pull out anything that's been revealed. So there's this sense that they are a companion, if you like, you know, because they do tend to hang around. So if you spend an afternoon in the garden, like I did last summer, lifting up slabs, you'll have a robin that might appear and spend that afternoon with you, working alongside you. As you move the slab, the robin will hop down and grab whatever is now available. And the robin also, unlike other small birds that tend to hang around in groups, if you think about sparrows, they're often in large numbers, the robin often hangs around by itself. And so, again, there's this willingness to come close to us, especially for feeding. You know, you can actually, I don't want to use the word tame, but you can sort of train a robin. If you feed the robin regularly enough and you know, bring that food closer and closer to you, you can actually get a robin to feed out of your hand.
And what do they like eating? What are their favourite foods?
Oh, you know, they'll eat a range of things. So, you know, as I said already, grubs, earthworms, berries, seeds, fruits. Obviously they'll feed from feeders, so, you know, fat balls and so on, but yeah, a range of different things.
Now, I've heard that while in the UK we've got this association with the robin being a friendly garden bird, but it's not necessarily the case across the rest of its range. Is that true?
Yeah, so you do tend to see robins in gardens and cities in the UK. You do across large parts of Europe. But, you know, you might tend to find robins in woodland and scrubland in places like Russia, or, you know, if you're talking about North Africa, in mountainous regions, in kind of low mountainous regions. So it isn't the case that robins occupy the same kinds of habitats across its range.
Because how long will robins live for?
So the longest, or the oldest robin on record, well, actually there's two. So it's between 17 and 19 years old is the oldest robin on record, but that is incredibly rare. Birds that have been ringed tend to be between the ages of 4 and 6, but they do have a very high mortality rate. So actually a lot of robins don't survive the first winter. There are a lot of stories about people who talk about the robins in their garden and how long they've lived. And there's a really nice account from the ornithologist David Lack, who talked about a seminar that he gave on robins and was talking about their high mortality rate. And somebody in the audience was incredibly upset because they had been feeding their garden robin for 17 years. Now, given that the oldest robin on record is 17, 19 years, perhaps that was the case. But as he pointed out at the time, that is highly unlikely. And she was very upset by that.
Now, you said that the robins will come back to your garden, or it certainly seems that way. They're quite territorial birds, aren't they?
They are territorial birds, yes. So we hear a lot about how friendly the robin is, this friendly kind of cherished bird, but they do have this other side to them that is also talked about. They are highly territorial. They occupy territory all year round, which is quite unusual, and they will defend that territory. So the red breast is one of the mechanisms that they use to warn other birds off, and they will also use song as well. So the song that they are very famous for and that they're loved for is also a part of their territorial practice. So they'll use song to demarcate the edges of their territory and protect that territory. So yes, very, very territorial birds, and they will fight off other robins that try and take over parts of their territory.
And talking of that song a bit more, they sing all year round, which is, again, quite unusual among the birds, isn't it?
Yes, that's right. Well, they sing all year round, but it's also to do with the robin being present, well, particularly in the UK, in the British Isles. The robin is present all year round and it holds a territory all year round. So a lot of other birds will migrate, whereas the robin stays put and tends to overwinter here as well. So you will hear them all year round.
So how can the robin deal with our winter temperatures when loads of other birds migrate? Is it just a real tough bird?
Yeah, again, yeah. So in Britain, the milder winters mean that the birds tend to stay put. But actually, we look at the European robin across its range, it does migrate. So in the UK, we might see, or we do see, an influx of robins over winter from Scandinavia. So these are birds that are flying south for the milder winters in the British Isles. So we, you know, not only do you see robins in the winter because they stay behind, but we also see greater numbers because we have an influx as well. And then birds across the continent will also move south and southwest for warmer climes. Interestingly, the European robin was actually involved in some of the studies in the 1950s that actually told us a lot about why birds migrate or how birds migrate. So it was almost by accident that it was found that birds used magnetic sense, so the Earth's magnetic field, to direct them. So some robins were held in a tank, and that tank prohibited them from seeing celestial cues. So it was thought that they used stars and so on to navigate themselves. When they were put in this tank, they didn't have access to any of these cues. And for the first couple of days, the robins that were held there were disorientated. So they weren't facing in the right direction that we would expect them to go during their migration. However, after several days, it was found that these robins did start to reorientate themselves and were then eventually facing in the right way. So there was obviously something there that wasn't a celestial cue that was important to their migration. And what it was found was that this tank had blocked out partially part of the Earth's magnetic field. There was still a weak sense of it. And so over those days, the robins that had been kept in that tank gradually readjusted themselves to this magnetic field. And so that is what they were using. So then after this initial experimentation, they ran another set of tests where they used powerful magnets to disrupt this magnetic field. And as they expected, the robins then reorientated themselves based on this change to the magnetic field that they were in. So robins actually became a part of this new research on bird migration and understanding around magnetic sense.
So you were saying there about how we get this big influx of robins over the winter months in the UK. Now, is that how they came to be associated with Christmas?
Yeah. So there's a number of reasons why they're associated with Christmas. One of them is their presence. So yes, they are very visible as well. You know, as we lose a lot of foliage and the leaves on our trees, they're more exposed. You can see them. They're very vocal. There are more of them. So there's that sense that robins are far more present, or certainly feel far more present in our gardens. There's also a lot of emphasis on their song and the cheer that they bring, you know, to those kind of cold winter mornings. But it's actually more to do with their red breast. So because of their red breast and their association with the colour, we also see a link to the British Postal Service. So the British Postal Service used to have these scarlet uniforms, and so they earned themselves the nickname. The nickname was Robins. So what you had was, when people used to have their post delivered, and this was before every household had a letterbox. So the postal workers would bring letters directly to people's door and hand them to the recipients. And so what you would have was this kind of account of the robins bringing you your mail. So when the Christmas card became popular, robins with mailbags and bring-in letters were actually very, very popular as a design for those Christmas cards. And so that is where that association comes from. So yeah, it's to do with their red breast and that long link to the colour red.
And it's not just with the association with Christmas. They've also got this link to some of our folklore. I mean, there's some really quite nasty old children's nursery rhymes about the robin, like Who Killed Cock Robin? And you just think, how did they get so associated with these nursery rhymes?
Yeah, again, so that would be a combination of their familiarity, their popularity, but also the colour red. So the colour red has this rich symbolism that links it to blood, that links it to fire. And so there's a lot of origin stories that are linked to robins and where they got their red breast from that links it to blood and fire. So, you know, Who Killed Cock Robin? As you said, it's quite a gruesome nursery rhyme. It sees the robin shot and killed with an arrow by a very sort of villainous sparrow. And so you can imagine visually, you know, there's lots of, when you, if you look it up, there are lots of great images of this, but you know, this arrow right through the chest, and you've got this kind of red breast, you know, the blood of the robin. So you can see how it becomes a focus for this kind of rhyme. Another rhyme that made it, or another tale that made it very significant to folklore, was the children in the wood, the babes in the wood. And this is two children that are led into the wood by an uncle who is looking to take their inheritance after the children's parents died. And the children are left there. They die as a result of exposure. And then robins come along and give them some kind of dignity in death. And that dignity is achieved by covering the children in leaves. There's kind of the robins perform a burial, and that is linked to their behaviour. So if you look at the way that robins feed on the ground, they tend to move leaves around. They'll throw up moss to get at what's underneath. And so you can see how, again, you know, that sort of observation of their behaviour lends itself to that kind of account of a burial.
I was reading that in the book and thought it was so interesting, that bit about it, how it's all in the folklore there. So back in the present day, I suppose, how are robins coping with climate change and insecticides and all that sort of stuff happening at the moment?
Yeah, so climate change for birds generally actually is likely to affect their migrations. So as I said, you know, in the UK, in the British Isles, robins tend to stay put and don't tend to migrate. But what we might see are earlier migrations from elsewhere. So, for example, you might see, I mean, if we look at the American robin, there is evidence to suggest that American robins are migrating 5 days earlier, so earlier in the spring. And that's recognizing the fact that spring is arriving earlier, that temperatures are rising earlier, and so on. So with bird migration, yeah, the birds that overwinter in Scandinavia might stay put instead of coming to the British Isles. But then you also see an increase in robins in northern areas where winters are becoming milder, and then decreases as a result in southern areas. But then there are other things that that are linked to climate change that might have an impact on robins. So, for example, if you have very, very dry summers, it might affect berry crops and fruits and what is available. So if you think about what they rely on for their foods, it might also impact insects. You know, so if insects are out earlier in the year, again, this affects their food source and when they can get it. And then also water. You know, if we think about the summer that we've just had, summers are getting warmer. We've had a very, very dry summer. And of course, water is important for birds like robins. There are other things to think about as well. So, I mean, you know, when thinking about climate change, obviously we've got a lot of focus on renewable energy sources and how that becomes a part and parcel of thinking about how we try and combat climate change. So we might think about the wind turbines and the turn to wind energy. There's been some great studies by researchers at Newcastle University that has looked at the impact of wind turbines and the noise that they make on robin communication and robin song. And of course, if they use their song to communicate territory and to defend territory. When wind turbines block out some of that, then actually that changes the way that territories are protected, and you might end up with more aggressive combats, and combats for robins can be quite lethal. So when thinking about climate change, yeah, there's it's migration, it's the impact that it has on their food sources and water, but then also those other things that are perhaps less obvious, like the turn to renewable energy.
And you said there about the wind turbine noise, but also light pollution can be a problem for some birds, can't it? It can throw out when they start singing.
That's right, yeah. So there's been a number of studies that have looked at the impacts of artificial lighting. So if you think in particular of robins in cities and how our cities now are lit up 24/7. So artificial lighting has been linked to changes in the daily timing of robin song. So they're singing earlier in the morning, they're singing later at night, because there is a relationship between singing and light and how they perceive light. But it's also an impact on their kind of seasonal rhythms as well. So there were studies that have been carried out in southern Germany where it's found that male robins are more likely to sing earlier in the season at sites that were affected by light pollution. This is because a network of brain nuclei, this is known as the song control system, that's really responsible for song production and learning. And the regulation of this song control system is actually influenced by hormones, which these hormones are the hormones that facilitate sleep. So there's a real tight link between light, the stimulation of the song control system. And then, of course, if you've got artificial light, this reduces melatonin levels. And so winter days that are lengthened with artificial light might be perceived as spring days. And so, you're triggering what seems to be an earlier singing in some robins. What impact that has on robins is unknown at the moment. You know, does that mean that you end up with more robin broods across a year because they're starting earlier in the year with their singing and with their breeding? Or does it mean that actually it's using up a lot more energy, and so you have more robin broods, but perhaps less successful robin broods? You know, there's a lot of question marks over that.
So robins are obviously facing a few problems here. How can we help the robins or encourage them into our gardens, give them a bit of an easier time of it?
Yeah, so there's a lot of things that you can do to encourage robins into your garden. I mean, when people think about encouraging birds in, the first thing they'll think about is feeding. You know, so obviously, particularly in the UK, you know, we are known for feeding our garden birds, for putting out fat balls and so on, you know, and robins will feed from feeders. So whether that's hanging feeders, there are ground feeding birds. You can also get those feeders that you can put on the ground that come with those cages that you can put over them to stop other predators and that getting in. So always think about where these are located and whether or not they're accessible by cats. But I would say there are other things that we should consider beyond simply putting out food. And that goes back to what they eat naturally. So thinking about how we garden. Even if you've only got a very small garden, you can look at the types of plants that you're putting in. Are there native species there to provide berries and seeds? So you might think about fruit trees or apples or blackberries, for example, mistletoe, very popular with robins. So thinking about what you actually plant in your garden can have a really big impact on the birds that you might entice in and might provide a haven for. Beyond feeding, you might also consider where, you know, robins tend to nest. So robins tend to nest in cavities. They like ivy, for example. So they like places that they can hide away in. And we've got a couple at the bottom of our garden, and we've got quite a dense bit of ivy that's grown up against the fence. Things like this are really important for attracting robins because they will use it. So dense vegetation, places that they can rest, places that they can nest. And then going back to that question about climate change and water, you know, all birds need water. If you can provide somewhere that they can bathe in, so a bird bath, even a small pond, and they can be tiny, a small amount of water in your garden will attract all kinds of birds, not just robins, but all kinds of birds very, very quickly.
And thinking a bit more about their nesting habits, how many eggs will robins generally lay?
Oh, 6 to 7, generally.
And will the male and female work together, or will the male sort of play away a bit or something like that when they're bringing up the babies?
They normally work together. It's a very, very busy time. There are a lot of hungry mouths to feed. It takes up a lot of energy. So there's a lot of food to be sought. It tends to be females that build the nest, but other than that, they do tend to work very closely together.
And the babies don't hatch out with a red breast, do they? That develops later as they mature.
That is correct, yes. So whilst the adult robin is very, very easy to recognise because of that distinctive red breast, juvenile robin is actually very hard to identify. So it's tends to be all brown, has quite yellowish streaks and spots. And the juvenile doesn't tend to start developing its adult plumage until it's about 10 weeks old. And it then takes several more months before it has that kind of full plumage. So while that process is underway, they do look very scruffy and quite unusual. So you have these little patches of orange that are starting to appear. But they can be quite hard to identify.
Now, when I was researching this podcast, I was reading all about robin's eggs, and I know you talk about them in the book as well. Now, there's this colour robin's egg blue, which is this lovely sort of bluish green colour. And when I was digging into a bit more, you'd find out that it's actually American robins and not British robins that have that blue colour. Now, I know in this podcast we're talking a bit more about British robins, but that blue colour for an egg for the American robin, that seems like a really strange colour choice. Wouldn't that make it stand out more to predators?
Well, this is an area where there is a lot of experimentation and scientific investigation, and there are many hypotheses around why different birds have different colour eggs. So starting with the European robin, yes, the European robin's egg is actually white and speckled. They tend to be quite hidden, so that's not too much of an issue. But yeah, people do often confuse the two, precisely as you say, because of the popularity of robin's egg blue, which is this kind of this lovely colour that's become especially popular in paint. But with the American robin, so there has been a couple of studies that have been done that suggest that the more vibrant the blue, the more time and effort and energy a male robin will invest in providing for those eggs. So the more intense the blue, the more likely that the female robin is more healthy. So one of the hypotheses, and this is just one, is that the colour can tell us something about, you know, the health of a bird. But I mean, it's an area of investigation that has grown rapidly. You know, as we've had advances in technology and digital cameras, we know a lot more about colour pigmentation, and we can recognise intensities of colour more easily. We also know a lot more about how birds see things, so what parts of the spectrum they can see. And, you know, in combination, we can make hypotheses, but there's still a lot more to be done yet to fully understand that.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Instant Genius. That was Helen Wilson. Her book, Robin, published by Reaction Books, is out now. The latest issue of BBC Science Focus magazine is now available. Pick up a copy in store or visit sciencefocus.com.